WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is avant-garde composer John Cage. John Cage has devoted his life to challenging our preconceptions about music and art. Cage studied composition and 12-tone music with Arnold Schoenberg in the early 1930s. But instead of pursuing Schoenberg's vision of a new order in music, Cage eventually abandoned the idea of order in favor of composing through chance processes. He saw chance-generated music as a way to release his music from the limits of his own taste, memory, and emotion. His radical ideas about composition led to equally radical experiments with instruments. By 1937, Cage created what he called the prepared piano, which is a method of altering the piano's tonal and percussive qualities by placing wood, metal, or rubber objects on the piano strings. He later became one of the first composers to use synthesizers and computers. Sometimes Cage didn't use instruments at all. Instead, he tried to capture and control sounds like the static between radio stations or the noise of trucks going by and use them as instruments. One of the ongoing influences on Cage's music and life has been Zen Buddhism. Before we meet him, why don't we listen to a piece that combines Cage's interests in Eastern philosophy, chance processes, and electronics. This is an excerpt of his 1959 work, Indeterminacy, in which Cage tells 90 stories in 90 minutes, giving 1 minute for each story, no matter what the length of that story is. The piano and electronic music score was composed and realized by David Tudor. Cage and Tudor allow the voice and music to collide and let the music sometimes drown out the voice.
This summer I'm going to give a class in mushroom identification at the New School for Social Research. Actually, it's 5 field trips, not really a class at all. However, when I proposed it to Dean Clara Meyer, though she was delighted with the idea, she said, "I'll have to let you know later whether or not we'll give it." So she spoke to the president, who couldn't see why there should be a class in mushrooms at the new school. Next, she spoke to Professor McIver, who lives in Piermont. She said, "What do you think about our having a mushroom class at the new school?" He said, "Fine idea. Nothing more than mushroom identification develops the powers of observation." This remark was relayed both to the president and to me. It served to get the class into the catalog and to verbalize for me my present attitude toward music. It isn't useful, music isn't, unless it develops our powers of audition. But most musicians can't hear a single sound. They listen only to the relationship between two or more sounds. Music for them has nothing to do with their powers of audition, but only to do with their powers of observing relationships. In order to do this, they have to ignore all the crying babies, fire engines, telephone bells, coughs that happen to occur during their auditions. Actually, if you run into people who are really interested in hearing sounds, you're apt to find them fascinated by the quiet ones. "Did you hear that?" they will say. In 1954, when I went to Europe, I no sooner arrived in Paris than I noticed that the city was covered with posters publicizing a mushroom exhibition that was being held in the botanical gardens. That was all I needed. Off I went. When I arrived, I found myself in a large room filled with many tables upon which were displayed many species of fungi. On the hour, from a large centrally placed loudspeaker, a recorded lecture on the deadly poisonous amanitas was delivered. During this lecture, nobody in the hall moved or spoke. Each person's attention was, so to speak, riveted to the information being given. A week later, I was in Köln, in Germany, attending a concert of electronic music. There was also an audience and a large loudspeaker. However, many in the audience were dozing off, and some were talking to their neighbors. I went to a concert upstairs in Town Hall. The composer whose works were being performed had provided program notes. One of these notes was to the effect that there is too much pain in the world. After the concert, I was walking along with the composer, and he was telling me how the performances had not been quite up to snuff. So I said, "Well, I enjoyed the music, but I don't agree with that program note about there being too much pain in the world." He said, "What? Don't you think there's enough?" I said, "I think there's just the right amount."
That was an excerpt of the John Cage-David Tudor collaboration, Indeterminacy. Many listeners have been baffled and bothered by Cage's rejection of the principles of harmony and melody, which most composers work so hard to master. Cage is now 73. The skeptics who thought he would outgrow his radicalism were wrong.
I remember a lady in Chicago hearing what wild ideas I had in the early 40s. She said, "Oh, when you get older, you'll mellow."
And?
I'm not so sure that I'm mellowing. Some people may think that I am, but my feeling is that if I found a new idea or something that I don't yet know, that would be a great pleasure.
Since you're a celebrated artist now, and nearly everybody who doesn't even listen to new music knows about you and your work, do you find that you're met differently by audiences now, that they're more willing to give themselves over to what you're doing? And
it used to be very difficult to get 120 people together to listen to a program of music. Now I have to refuse many engagements in order to have time to do the next work that I haven't yet done. I have become, as it were, two people. One who's on paper, or is music and books and prints, and the other one who isn't any of those things, but who has an idea about making the next one. Another thing I do is I fight a war against paper, and in that war I'm on both sides. I both want to get rid of paper and I want to write on more of it.
If I may quote you from one of your books, you wrote, "What was it that actually made me choose music rather than painting? Just because they said nicer things about my music than they did about my paintings? But I don't have absolute pitch. I can't keep a tune. In fact, I have no talent for music. The last time I saw her, Aunt Phoebe said, 'You're in the wrong profession.'"
Right.
Why did you choose? Did you really feel that way about your music? And if so, why did you choose music over painting?
Well, my father was an inventor. And I've never thought that, as many people do, that music should be in my head and that I should learn how to write down what I already hear. I really can't hold a tune, and I don't know solfège at all. So that I found ways of writing music to produce sounds that I haven't heard and that other people haven't heard. If I'd studied solfège, if I had a feeling for harmony, which I don't, I think I would simply write what people have already heard, or what I would have thought I heard. The result is, I have a curious feeling every time I write a new piece, particularly one for orchestra that involves so many people and so much trouble, you know, to bring it into existence. I think up until the last minute that maybe it's just going to be a great mistake, or that we won't discover anything with it.
So you have to listen to your pieces as they're being done in probably a different way than most composers listen to
their work. I hear them for the first time, and I hear them with interest rather than critically. I try to hear what there is to hear.
So you won't walk away thinking, "That was a real success," or "That was a terrible failure. I won't do
no,
that again."
No, not that.
I think when you were studying with Schoenberg, and this is an indirect quote, he said something like, "You don't have an ear for harmonies, and that will always be for you like walking against, like knocking into a wall." And you said, "In that case, I'll bang my head against
right,
that wall for the rest
right,
of my career."
Right.
And a lot of your work hasn't been about that relationship of sounds to other sounds, but of sounds in and of themselves, individual sound, sound for itself. Is that too, do you think, from not wanting to work with harmony?
I had an interest in each single sound from the beginning. At first, I began putting the sounds together into, as I'd been taught, into motives and repeating them and varying them. But gradually, and through a study of Oriental philosophy, And through the use of chance operations, I have found ways, I think, of letting sounds move from their own centers rather than centers in my mind.
What's your attitude towards random sounds in your home? I'm thinking now of...
I just love them.
Uh-huh, like apartments in Manhattan, which is probably the noisiest city in the world.
I live on, and Sixth Avenue is very, very noisy. And sometimes there's burglar alarms.
Oh, yeah.
And they may last 3 or 4 hours. That's quite a problem. I think that we almost have an instinct to be annoyed by a burglar alarm. But as I pay attention to them, they're curiously, slightly varying.
What if you're paying attention to something else at the same time?
Well, I think that one of our most accessible disciplines now is paying attention to more than one thing at a time. And if we can do that with equanimity, then I would suggest paying attention to three things at the same time. And you can practice that as a discipline. I think it's more effective than sitting cross-legged. I mean to say cross-legged in relation
to... In meditation.
To, yes. It opens the... I think the meaning of meditation is to open the doors of the ego from a concentration on itself to a flow with all of creation, wouldn't you say? And if we can do this through the sense perceptions, through multiplying the things to which we're able at one and the same time to pay attention, I think we accomplish much the same thing. At least that's my faith.
So you don't shut yourself in and try to make things very quiet so you can concentrate on what you're doing?
No. One of the lectures that Suzuki gave that impressed me so much was on the structure of the mind. And he drew a kind of an oval on the board. And he put two parallel lines halfway up the left-hand side. And he said, this is the structure of the mind, and this is the ego, those two parallel lines. And the ego goes out through the sense perceptions to the world of relativity, or it goes in through dreams to the absolute. And then the fact that it was a continuous line, like a circle or like an oval, made me have the faith that instead of sitting cross-legged or doing special things about Zen Buddhism, that I could continue with my music and treat it in a disciplined way through the use of chance operations, so that instead of expressing myself, as so many artists think their responsibility is, I could alter myself so that I would flow with my experience.
So
that's been my project.
Did D.T. Suzuki ever get to hear much of your music? And I wonder what he thought of the uses you were making of the I Ching.
Well, when I remember going to him once and asking him a question about music, because I wanted to know from him whether I was going, in quote, in the right direction by using chance operations. And he very quickly said to me, I know nothing about music. I think that was not true, but what he meant was that I had to make up my own mind and not have him make it up for me.
You said at one point that your problems in your performances were becoming not musical but social, and that you saw composing as a way of instructing people's behavior, controlling people's behavior, and you wanted to get out of that. So what's the difference between composing and having people perform it, composing through like traditional methods, and composing through chance? Is it a different way of shaping someone's behavior when you're working through chance processes?
No, chance is one thing, and working with music as though it were a social situation that was a desirable social situation is something else, and has led me to think of what we call indeterminacy. In other words, making my music so that it doesn't force the performers of it into a particular groove, but which gives them some space in which they can breathe and do their own work with a degree of originality.
Do you like to speak with performers before they perform one of your pieces, if it's people who you know?
I like to make suggestions and then see what happens, rather than setting down laws and forcing people to follow them.
And you're really curious to see how the sounds are going to come out. It's not like you
right.
know how it's supposed to sound.
Since I don't hear music in my head to begin with, I don't lose anything at all by leaving a little more freedom. The use of chance operations leads to a certain freedom, and the providing of suggestion rather than law leads to another, adds to it.
You've like rejected taste and memory in the chance processes work. What's restricting about taste and memory for you?
There's a beautiful remark of Marcel Duchamp: to reach the impossibility of transferring from one like object to another the memory imprint. And I think the trouble with memory, both from a poetic point of view, is made clear too by the remark of René Char, the French poet, that each act is virgin, even the repeated one. To see things as being new rather than things that we already know before we're experiencing them. I think this is one of the things that leads to trouble between two people when someone says of another person, I knew what she would say, or I knew what he would say. I would hope that we don't get into that frame of mind with respect to one another.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because you have such a really rich and detailed memory and use it so beautifully in your storytelling and in your writings, which become your pieces also. Mm. I know that memory does come into play.
There's another remark I've come across in the last year or so that I like, and it's by the composer Erik Satie. And it's related to that remark that I just quoted from Char, each act is virgin. Satie says, experience is a form of paralysis. Do you see the relation? If we think we know what the other person is going to say, and if we don't approach things as virgin, then our minds and our attitudes to our life become paralyzed. And that's why we want to have each thing new. To realize that two Coca-Cola bottles are not identical. And what makes them not identical is that they're not at the same point. They can't be at the same point in space. Since they're not at the same point in space, they automatically receive, each one receives light differently than the other, so that it can be as fascinating as going to a museum to look carefully, attentively at two Coca-Cola bottles. And something of that is implicit in a great deal of 20th century art.
That kind of perception, I think sometimes, like when you walk into a museum or a concert hall, it's like your senses get turned on because you're paying money, you're walking in, you're going here especially to experience something sensual. Whereas when you go to work in the morning or when you're going to take the subway or something, you kind of turn down a lot of those senses. You're not expecting a sensual experience, and you're maybe expecting things that you're not going to want to see or hear too
much. It's marvelous, though, when we are surprised by coincidences of light or sound and our presence. That's one of the beautiful things about hunting mushrooms, is that they grow up and are fresh at just a particular moment. And our lives are actually characterized by moments.
Can Can I quote you again? You said, where there's a history of organization, introduce disorder. Where there's a history of disorganization, introduce order.
Mm.
Can you think of times when you've introduced order into your art where there's been a history of disorganization? Has there ever been a situation
well,
like that?
What I was thinking of when I made the remark was that in the world of art, where there's been established relationships, that there we need the freedom given by irrationality. Whereas in the treatment of the relation between a society and the world on which we live, there has been a kind of idiotic mishandling of natural resources. And I think Buckminster Fuller has a very clear and useful way to bring about an equation, a proper relationship, a proper organization between nature and society, human beings. And we need that very much. We don't need to have rivers that could burst into flame, you know.
I think your life is like this great dialectic between things like between computers and the I Ching, or between having to know what mushroom to pick so that you don't kill yourself and your friends by doing the poisonous one, and then using chance processes for your music and poetry. Do you consciously decide which each of those will be, or do you just kind of naturally have those interests in
I think we
both
should,
sides?
We can tell rather clearly when we're in what the Indians call an artha circumstance, which is a circumstance where you have a goal and you don't want to kill yourself, or you want to win as in a game, or you want to cross the street without getting killed, or you want to hunt wild mushrooms and not kill yourself, and so on. That's one way of living. Another way of living is having and giving pleasure, kama. And another way is following the good rather than the evil. I think which is dharma in Indian philosophy, is very close to what in Christianity is faith, hope, and charity, such things. And then in Buddhism there is moksha, which is liberation from all those three concerns. And normally if we went to school, we would think, well, we start in artha, we go to kama, we go to dharma, and we graduate and get into moksha. But I think the truth of the matter is that we're in all four all of the time, and that we live a life characterized by inconsistency.
Well, another thing that sounds...
And that's the marvelous thing. You can then write a poem, as the Japanese monk did, on having reached enlightenment. You can say, now that I'm enlightened, I'm just as miserable as ever.
I like to think of I like to think
and
of...
And that characterizes, you know, the way we feel, don't you think?
Yeah, well...
And say you get exhausted toward the end of the day, and don't you have the experience of finding life not quite so bad the next morning when you wake up full of new energy?
Yeah. I like to think of you and Marcel Duchamp playing chess together, because here...
Well, we actually didn't play
much. You didn't
play? No.
Oh.
I played with Tini Duchamp, his wife, and he would criticize our game. And he said to me once, he said, don't you ever want to win?
Yeah, did you play to win when you played chess?
I didn't then. I played chess in order to be with him. I wanted to be with him as much as possible. Now that he's dead... my game is improved.
Did you talk much during those chess games with Tini?
No, I had a kind of confidence that if I was just near Duchamp, that would be enough. That I didn't have to ask him questions or converse. Once I remember, he said, "Let's sit down and have a conversation." We sat down, and I don't remember what we talked about.
Was that?
I just liked being with him.
Was that so, that being with him and not talking got for you some of what you wanted to be?
Yes, I think his presence, his being, was both question and answer. Hmm?
Did you talk much about art?
No.
Did you know that he was doing that piece that
no,
no one knew that
no,
he was
I
doing
didn't know
at the
it
museum?
Either. I didn't know it either. I didn't know it until after he died, and then Tini Duchant took me to see it in New York before it moved here to Philadelphia.
Did you feel cheated by that?
No. No, no, I thought it was marvelous that he had led us to believe that he had given up working and that all the time he was busy as a bird dog.
He's the kind of artist that a lot of people, I think, wanted to copy his behavior as much as...
He meant by that he had gone underground.
Uh-huh.
He used to say an artist must go underground in order to get anything done. And he needed, I think, in his work, as I have trained myself not to need, he needed solitude in which to work. I can work. I have studied being interrupted, and I can work whether I have solitude or not. I've had to do that because of my association with dancers. But another thing that Marcel used to talk about in those last years of his life, and which recurred in his conversation, not with me, but I noticed when other people were in the room, he somehow would arrange it so that it came up. He said, why is it that artists are willing for people to look at their work from any distance? And he, of course, was thinking of the Etant Donné, in which he obliges them to look through the peephole of the door. But no one had thought, before he thought of it, of making such a situation in which he would control the position of the observer. And for him to control who had been the one to remove control from art. Hmm? That was what was so marvelous about him, was doing two great works, the Etant Donné and the big and the large glass, and have them be essentially so paradoxical in relation to one another.
That was avant-garde composer John Cage, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air.